Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you tuned in this morning. In the first part of the show today, we'll be talking about some of the continuing controversy surrounding security at the nation's nuclear weapons lab. There has been concern for some time now that one country, China, was involved in espionage, nuclear espionage, trying to get information about the design and construction of weapons that they could then apply to their own nuclear arsenal. And in fact, last May, a committee of the House released a report saying that the Chinese had done just that. We'll be talking about that whole contention and also the response of some scientists to that, because indeed a group of scientists from Stanford issued a fairly detailed rebuttal recently of this report that came out of the House Select Committee headed by Chris Cox and known as the Cox Report. It is available online, by the way, and it's extremely long. We'll talk a little bit about the Cox Report and the response of the gentleman from Stanford. Also, there are people who are concerned that just one individual is the chief suspect in all of this, and a nuclear engineer named Wen Ho Li, who has been indicted in this, and interestingly enough, not indicted for passing secrets to the Chinese, but indicted for unauthorized removal of information from the lab where he worked there at Los Alamos. Our guest for this hour is Jeremiah Sullivan. He's professor of physics here at the University of Illinois and has been a member of the faculty for quite some time. He works not only in theoretical physics, but also in the areas of arms control and international security and science and public policy. And he's been with us before to talk about various sorts of arms control subjects. In fact, the last time he was here was just before the Senate voted on the comprehensive test ban treaty, which was defeated by the Senate to the great unhappiness of him and a lot of other folks. So a different topic, but certainly related here, that we'll take up this morning. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. If you would like to call, you're welcome to do that. We just ask people to try and be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible, but we'll be very happy to hear from folks. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, again, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back, David.
I did take a look at least the overview of the Cox Report, which itself was fairly long, but right at the very first point, the conclusion of the committee, fairly unequivocal, that their conclusion was that the People's Republic of China has stolen design information on the United States' most advanced thermonuclear weapons, and that they feel that not only did they take that information, but that they are going to use that information for developing new weapons that they would have. What do you think about that conclusion? And in fact, do you and other people question this most basic conclusion that the Chinese were involved in nuclear espionage, and that they got information that they can and will use to develop new weapons on their side?
Okay, well, it's sort of two sets of facts here. One, it is established that the Chinese did learn information about U.S. nuclear weapon designs, and that is often referred to as the 1995 walk-in document. A person which had some association with the U.S. intelligence agency walked into some office in a country outside of, not China, and gave this U.S. official a booklet or a document which had drawings and information. It was in Chinese. It was marked as a Chinese government document, a classified Chinese government document, and turned it over to us. About a year later, the U.S. government figured out that this person actually worked for the Chinese intelligence community. And so it's clear that the Chinese government gave us this information, wanted us to know that they had obtained it. It had information about six or seven of the most modern design nuclear weapons in the stockpile, all of which are generally of the same type, but had drawings and the like, according to the information the public media. We don't know how they actually obtained that information. That's one of the unknowns, but we know they did obtain that. Assessments have been made by several different groups and panels, including the Cox Commission, about what impact that has had on the Chinese programs and what is the consequences for U.S. security. So the basic facts of obtaining information are clear. The other assessments of it is where the differences arise. So that's one body of information. The second is relates to Los Alamos National Laboratory and a scientist there, a U.S. citizen born in Taiwan, Dr. Wenho Li, who has been fired and most recently in the last week or so had criminal charges brought against him, not espionage, but for mishandling of classified information. Mm-hmm. There is no connection between these two pieces of information, although that is barely recognizable in the media, especially the media stories that burst out last summer following information from the Cox Report and the like. And it seems clear that the Justice Department doesn't have any connecting information, otherwise they would have brought charges of a different nature. So that's the the basic framework of the controversy that's going on today, and there's fallout and reactions to it in many different directions.
When we talked last time about the test ban, I think one of the things we talked about was, or perhaps it had been in an earlier program on this subject, looking at this question of how much information about the design and construction of nuclear weapons is available in some sort of public non-secret form. You know, how much you could actually find out going through established channels, what's out there, without having to steal anything that was secret, and how much information is available, provided that one would know where to look.
The general principles are certainly publicly available. The basic physics of nuclear weapons, including thermonuclear weapons, which is the type we have and the type that the Chinese got information about. But they had thermonuclear weapons even before they obtained the information, which we think, by the way, happened back in the Reagan administration. So we learned about it from them in 1995, but the assessment has been made or that it occurred much earlier. What the Chinese could do with this information is sort of improve their knowledge, and that's the sort of judgment, I think, of the panels that have made the best assessments of the impact of this, that they will, you know, fold it in to the information they have from their own work and past testing, but that they almost certainly haven't made a carbon copy of our weapons and would not do that and deploy that. That, I think, is, you know, the most reasonable assessment. In a sense, the fact they already had thermonuclear weapons, missiles which could reach the United States, not all parts of the United States, that represents a threat which is not fundamentally changed by the additional information they've learned. In a sense, you know, you could think of it as they formerly had a Chevrolet, and if the information they got enables them to improve things, now they have a Cadillac or Jaguar or something. But they still have the ability, and they've long had it, to destroy United States cities. So things have not fundamentally changed.
Even if there's still some question about what they might have learned and how they might have learned it, but setting aside those facts, if we look at the security implications for the United States of whatever it is they may have learned, we would say that the situation that we face, the security threat that we face today, is no greater than the security threat that we faced 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
I wouldn't go quite that far. I mean, it's somewhat greater, but it's not fundamentally different. And whether they have missiles with single large warheads or missiles with multiple smaller warheads does not fundamentally change the fact that they have tremendous destructive capability. And, you know, much of the nuclear arms race was about 10% improvements here and there, and the fundamental threat and threat to mankind is present from the existence of the weapons, and even early designs established that.
But let me reintroduce our guest here this morning for anyone who might have tuned in the last 3, 4, 5 minutes. Jeremiah Sullivan is our guest. He's professor of physics at the University of Illinois and is interested and has done research in the area of arms control and international security. And he's been with us before on this program to talk about that very topic. And here this morning we're talking about some of the recent concerns over security at some of the nation's nuclear weapons lab, or perhaps just one of them, which has been singled out at Los Alamos. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I know certainly that that many people in the United States, certainly within the Asian American community, are concerned about the fact that just one individual has been singled out, Wenho Lee, and that, and again, as I said, and you pointed out, he has not been charged with espionage, only with unauthorized use. Maybe we could just look at that for a second. What is it that is alleged that he did?
What he's charged with is improperly downloading codes and information on a classified computer system at Los Alamos National Laboratory and transferring that to an unclassified computer in his office, and further that he copied some of that information onto tapes. I assume these are large computer tapes, not the usual cassettes we think about, and that there were 10 such tapes, and 7 of them are unaccounted for. I assume that means the Justice Department, the FBI, knows or has the other 3. But the defense attorney for Dr. Lee says that he destroyed those tapes. The data that Dr. Lee downloaded, he had clearances to access those files. There's no doubt about that. So the charges pertain to mishandling, not properly safeguarding classified materials. One is not allowed to. It's a violation of requirements to put classified codes and information on an unclassified computer system, and it's further a violation to carry such materials outside of the laboratory without appropriate safeguarding and the like. So that's the basis of the charges against him.
And of course, we can only speculate, and I'm hesitant to do a lot of speculation. I'm sure we'll hear if this comes to trial, there'll be coverage presumably, and he will have the opportunity to make his case. Maybe I would just ask simply how, from your perspective, what he is alleged to have done, how serious is that?
I think it's a very serious violation of security requirements. The thing that is special about this case is the large volume of material he downloaded and allegedly copied onto tapes. But, you know, that's apparently where the evidence trail ends. It, you know, doesn't go beyond that. Some people feel that, well, he didn't do anything different than others who may have occasionally taken classified data home to work, brought back the next day or whatever. But all that will be, you know, issues that will come out in the trial, and I'm not going to speculate about that. One other former federal official of some well-known, John Deutsch, was former head of the CIA, in fact, was found to have some classified files on his home computer, and He's lost his security clearances because of that, but hasn't been subject to criminal prosecution. So people have pointed to that as sort of unequal and unfair treatment of Dr. Lee, who did something similar. It's a matter of judgment, and I'm not going to speculate on that about whether those are similar or not. But, you know, it is an improper activity to do that with classified information. There's no doubt about that. But what was the source of the Chinese information, you know, is only speculation. The Cox Committee, I think, probably convinced themselves that it came from Dr. Lee, but there's no evidence to about that. Mm-hmm. In fact, the walk-in document was analyzed, and the information in it was judged, apparently, if I'm talking from media reports, to have correspond to dates which precede any of the downloading of documents of computer files by Dr. Lee. So that makes the connection even harder to make, even if you want to believe that.
The as I mentioned, certainly Asian Americans in this country are concerned about the Dr. Lee and his situation and the fact that he's been singled out, and that it, all of this happens at a time when there's tension in the relationship between China and the United States. And he being Chinese American, apparently they, some people felt that that was natural to make that suspicion, and I think that Asian Americans are saying, well, wait a minute, let's not necessarily assume, because they're, you know, we're talking about China here, and China, and he is Chinese American, that right away on the basis of race we should make some kind of association. I just wonder though, from your perspective as a scientist, as a physicist, someone who works and has concerns in this area, do you have concerns about the fact that that a fellow scientist is the target of such an investigation?
Well, I'm not concerned that the person is a scientist, but I am very concerned about the way the case has been handled. It's clear that it was very poorly handled and mishandled, in fact, by the FBI, the Department of Justice, but also by the Cox Commission and the like. And I'm concerned of the repercussions and the implications for the scientists and engineers at the weapons laboratories, and also for the future of those laboratories, because that relates back and impacts the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty we talked about the last time I was here. The access of foreign visitors to the DOE laboratories has been severely curtailed. And then, the first response of some of the people in government was to close the door, no more foreign visitors. But that also closes the door to foreign visitors primarily who are coming to talk about open science and technology issues. Foreign visitors only rarely are there in a nuclear weapons context, and in that case they're scientists from China on occasion and Russia, who are under very carefully managed programs, interacting with some of our people so that we can better safeguard nuclear materials and the like. That's important, particularly in Russia, but we've learned a lot about the Chinese program from Chinese scientists who are here. And on balance, those are a tremendous benefit to the United States. And if we lose that, we're blinding ourselves. But if the laboratories become places where ordinary scientists and engineers feel that they're under great suspicion, if particularly if they're foreign-born, although U.S. citizens, they're not going to take jobs there. And so the vitality of the labs is very threatened by the way the case at Los Alamos has been handled. Things have been tempered somewhat since then, but it's still a major concern, and so I share that concern. And even the FBI acknowledges that the case focused on Dr. Lee far too early, and they've gone back and reopened that investigation, and it remains to be seen whether they can find anything at this late date that will give them real information about how the Chinese learned what they learned.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? They're in Chicago. on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
I understand that the spying that allegedly was done, the way people talk, it might not be a problem now, but I understand it could be a problem 30 years down the road when the Chinese become more, when the military becomes more modernized. I'd like your, I guess, to comment on that. And also, I'd like him to comment on what he thinks about the threat of North Korea's nuclear program to this country.
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, if China goes forward and develops new nuclear designs informed by whatever they have learned from our designs, you know, that will, you know, enable them to put more warheads on a given missile, or by making the warhead smaller, or achieve a greater range with that missile. And that, you know, that's a serious matter. I don't minimize that. But they're not going to do that if they're not able to test those designs. No one would be, no nation would be foolish enough to copy some crude sketch of a nuclear weapon and deploy it without testing it.
Yeah, but the Chinese are not going to ask us for permission to test these weapons if they want to do it. They're going to go ahead and do it.
Okay, but if they test these weapons, we'll know about it. Okay.
Well, so what? I mean, they'll just say, so what? So you know about it.
Well, right, but, you know, we'll be in a situation that'll return us in some degree to the Cold War, where the ultimate defense against nuclear weapons is becomes just deterrence.
Well, isn't this a good good reason for the to go ahead with SDI? You know, I know a lot of liberal scientists were against this because they believe that we should all just get along, but I think this is a practical reason why we should develop this system.
Yeah, the basis for the ABM Treaty, which is the, you know, was the decision, goes back to the Nixon administration, actually originated in the Johnson administration, not to deploy national defenses against nuclear-armed missiles, was not that we trusted the other side or that we preferred deterrence or MAD, the mutual assured destruction doctrine, but it was a judgment about the technical infeasibility of making effective defenses against large attacks of nuclear-armed missiles.
Well, the thing of it is, though, you see, when scientists made this argument back then, there was a technology that didn't exist then that does now. I don't know what the technology will be like 30 years from now. I'm not sure you do, too. You're a lot smarter than I am, I'm sure. But you can do things today you couldn't do 35 years ago. 35 years ago, we couldn't walk on the moon. 35 years ago, we didn't have satellite television. I'm just saying, shouldn't we develop it somewhere down the road? And who knows, we might be able to get a more sophisticated version of it.
Well, we have learned a lot. In fact, the U.S. has a national program, which an important decision will be made in June of 2000 by the administration, whether to proceed with a, something called National Missile Defense. But this is a ground-based system primarily aimed at handling a very small attack, maybe 10 warheads, maybe 20 or so.
What do you think about the situation in North Korea?
Well, in fact, that is the primary motivation for such a national missile defense, but even its strongest proponents recognize that it would have very little effectiveness against a large Soviet attack, or Russian, I should say, and if the Chinese would do increase its missile numbers and forces, it would also be ineffective against that.
Do you think North Korea is a threat to us now or will be? The reason I'm asking is because we have a presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to mention his name, but he has stated that if he were to become president, he would consider a tactical strike against North Korea to take out whatever nuclear devices they have, and I think that's irresponsible. Listen, I don't think they're going to be that much of a threat to us, but I wanted to get your opinion on it.
I don't think North Korea is a threat to the United States at this time. If they do develop a nuclear weapon, the likelihood that they will try to deliver it by an intercontinental range ballistic missile is low. There are many other ways to attempt to deliver it by boat into a harbor or what have you. That doesn't mean we should ignore any nuclear weapons program in North Korea. In fact, we've been focusing strongly on that, and they've given access to a new site, underground site under development that concerned us mightily, and what we found was, in fact, there's no nuclear program in that site at all. We have people on the ground at their former plutonium reprocessing sites. So it's a concern, but North Korea is not going to continue indefinitely the way it is. Its economy is in disaster case. And so we should watch it, be concerned, but not be, do things that would make no sense and spend billions on ineffective programs.
I agree. I don't think the public would tolerate a war where we might lose 10 or 15,000 casualties or something like that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Jeremiah Sullivan. He's professor of physics at the University of Illinois and, among other things, has done research and writing in the area of arms control and international security. And he's been with us certainly many times before to talk about some of these issues. We're talking this morning about the issue of security at nuclear weapons labs and the possible theft of nuclear secrets by the Chinese. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just, I have a caller here we'll get right to, I promise, in Urbana, but for a second I would like to stay with this topic of anti-missile defense. And in fact, at the time we talked about the test ban, we were going to talk about that, and then the test ban came up, and we thought that was something that was important right at that moment, and we said we would change our topic a little bit. I think what has now happened recently in this discussion of anti-missile defense is that the focus has been shifted from the idea that it was possible to make a system that would defend against a large-scale attack, shifting to the idea that it's more reasonable to think the threat would be either an accidental launch, so we might be talking about one missile or a couple, or an attack from a country with a smaller arsenal, so that once again what we were talking about would be a small number. And now some people are arguing that while we could not build a system to defend against this large-scale attack, it's reasonable to think about building a smaller system designed to defend against a small, either accidental or a small intentional launch. And that seems to be sort of what we're talking about now. Is that something that at least on technical grounds we can say at this point, we think probably if we decided we wanted to build such a thing, we could and have a high expectation that it would work?
Well, the answer is we've long known that you can hit a bullet with a bullet, the one-on-one demonstration. That's never been the problem. The current national missile defense is being defined against a very small threat, and that certainly makes things easier, and there's no one that would claim it's technically infeasible to defend against such a small attack. What is unclear is what it'll cost, what degree of confidence you can have in the system, and how long will it take. Mm-hmm. The current schedule is that if the decision to go is made this coming June, that the system could be deployed and be operational in 2005. But a recent review by a group of people with experience in armed services in the Pentagon indicated that, in fact, the rapid testing, evaluation, deployment schedule that is on paper now for the National Missile Defense is unlikely to be achieved, and that it's going to take longer and will take more money and more tests than have been allowed. The schedules in this area of missile defense have almost always been driven politically, not technically. And when you try to do something that technically complex according to a schedule dictated by politics, that's a recipe for wasting a lot of money and for failure. An earlier report by that same group that reviewed national missile defense was titled Rush to Failure. And that was a critique of the programs as they existed then. And that still hasn't changed fundamentally.
Let's take another call here locally. Excuse me. Line number one in Urbana. Hello. Yes.
Well, my question follows what you've been talking about. If you were to grant that it is feasible to build this defense, that it would why would some entity planning such an attack use missiles? Why wouldn't they load up a bomb on a tramp steamer and steam it into New York Harbor?
Well, that's a good question and a very good point. I can't answer it because there is no answer to that. I think the proponents of missile defenses would say that missiles sort of seem to be a popular offensive tool. Our investments in them maybe tend to lead to that impression.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have the one advantage that once you launch it, it's very difficult to anyone to interfere with that. You don't have to get close to the target and the like, but there'd be no doubt as to where it came from, because we have space-based systems that will track the launch and the like.
That was my next point.
Yeah. But there's just a general fear about fast-moving things that go banging at night, and ballistic missiles seem to fit in that category. It's just a natural human thing to want to defend oneself, and I think that sort of is part of the reason that missile defenses are so popular, even though they're technically complex.
Well, the other scenario is, given the porosity of our borders,
mm-hmm.
and the, I understand from the nuclear engineers I have known, that it would be possible to smuggle in the parts of a nuclear weapon and then assemble them, and that you could put these parts into suitcases and carry them across a border. Again, what is the defense of an anti-missile defense?
Well, if one did all that, and I think it would not be easy, and having confidence that the resulting device, when assembled, would go off, and you could do it all without being caught, you know, is certainly not 100%. Your earlier suggestion of bringing the device in on a boat, which, you know, boats can come into New York Harbor, Los Angeles, Long Beach Harbor, what have you, you know, without any challenge, it'd be more plausible.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just seems to me that it doesn't give us a great deal of additional security to build such a defense.
Yeah. My own view is that the costs of missile defense will be probably the limiting factor as to what we do and how much we do. Because they'll be competing against other military needs, and you know, those are things which include salaries, retirement benefits, recruitment, retention of pilots of aircraft and the like for missions that the U.S. military is called upon to do, and peacekeeping and the like. So the budget will probably be the most limiting factor.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll have another Urbana caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yes.
I was curious as to how you feel the economic involvement of the United States and China would, in the future, dictate the response or actual lack of response to aggressive behavior on the part of China. Because we've seen in the past that the economic interests of the United States is quite often taken into consideration when foreign policy and aggressive foreign policy is established, such as in the Gulf War, such as in Vietnam. And we might actually see a test of this if China becomes aggressive with Taiwan, and our response may be quite different now, since there is such a large economic interest of the United States in China.
Yeah, I have no way of predicting how the U.S.-Chinese relationship will play out. I think from this past year and past several years, we can expect to have a lot of ups and downs in that. You know, we have interests, they have interests, and they don't coincide. But there's a lot in common, and that part is the economic connections you just described. If China were to forcefully take over Taiwan, you know, that would be a fundamental change in the relationship between the United States and China, and I'm sure we would not ignore that. But everything that went before that would then be in jeopardy, and presumably the Chinese understand that. But beyond that, I just can't speculate. I don't know. So I hope it goes well, but we need to watch carefully.
Isn't it the fact that it's not the United States' moral stances, but often its economic interests, which are dictating its foreign policy, especially military responses? And the more we become entrenched and invested in the economy of China, the more we turn over to China, if you would, a Trump card, which says that the United States' integrity and principles will even be further challenged in the future.
Well, but economic relations are a two-way street. If China lost the U.S. market for its exports, then it would have major internal problems. There's a tremendous trade, in fact, deficit with China because of all the goods that are come to this country. If you look at almost any Christmas decoration in the store now, it's made in China. Christmas tree lights are very cheap because of that. So China has a stake in the relationship too, but that doesn't mean mistakes won't be made either here or there. But economic relations, I think, I believe, overall provide a better way to resolve differences and to bring people together than walls and alliances and the like.
All right. I guess we'll have to see how it plays.
That's right.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Jeremiah Sullivan. He's professor of physics at the University of Illinois. He's been with us before on the program to talk about a number of issues involved in arms control and international security. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I wonder if we could return to this issue of the balancing of scientific openness and communication among scientists with the security concern. You talked earlier about the fact that you and perhaps other scientists were concerned that one of the initial responses to this to the worries that secrets were leaking out of Los Alamos, one of the first things was we said, well, then we're not going to admit any more scientists from outside of the United States, and that's not, for a number of reasons, that's not good. That exchange of information, that's the way science works. When scientists can get together, everybody could talk about everybody else's work. And also that you said that this was one way that we have learned something about what other countries are doing in terms of developing weaponry, as the scientists can get together and talk about what it is that they know. But at the same time, we do have to be concerned with the issue of secrecy. So then I guess the question is that really possible to have both, to maintain a high level of security on the one hand, and yet have the kind of openness that scientists really like on the other?
I think it is possible. It requires balancing, requires understanding of the fundamental issues. One thing that is scheduled to take place, which is a response to how to manage the relationship between science and nuclear weapons and our other responsibilities, is a reorganization of the Department of Energy, which will go into effect March 1st. Mm-hmm. Hasn't been much public notice about this yet, but it's going to happen. Congress included that in the DOE legislation of the last Congress, and it was signed by the President. The three nuclear weapons laboratories, which are Los Alamos, we mentioned before, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, and Sandia National Laboratory, together with other parts of the nuclear weapons complex, much smaller than it used to be, will be put into a separate semi-autonomous agency. Actually, it's going to be called the National Nuclear Security Administration, which will be a semi-autonomous unit within the Department of Energy, and the director of that agency will report only to the Secretary of Energy. And if all goes well, that agency will have primary responsibility for the security of its facilities and laboratories. The philosophy behind that is that one can handle security best if you do it at the, I'll say, working level, where you have the people involved with the work also are conscious of the security needs, aren't involved in the security measures that are taken so that they're appropriate for that agency. What this reorganization, which was recommended by a panel called the Rudman panel, four members of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which reported out last June, what they felt was that would improve security, but also make the measures more acceptable and understood by the participants. And you don't have to have the same measures at all DOE laboratories, just including more special ones at the weapons laboratories. So that will take place, but it also raises the problem of the non-nuclear weapon science that goes on at the laboratories. It'll be part of the new administration needs to have the communications to the outside world that we talked about earlier. And so lots of attention is being focused on how to do that and manage that and the like. And my prediction is that the new structure is a very useful step, but it will succeed only to the degree that the individuals that are appointed in the new agency and those remaining in the regular positions in the Department of Energy understand what's at stake and make, you know, day-to-day policies that respect what's important. But, you know, there's no fundamental secrets about nuclear weapons. It's not something that one can lock up in a safe and keep it away and put it away. No one else can do it. That's long gone, and it's a mistake to think that, you know, it's a matter of locks and keys. And the strength of this country ultimately is its economy, the power and quality of its science and technology, and that's what we need to protect. And that's where we could stumble if we don't.
That just raises a question in my mind. When you look at improvements, enhancements that have been made in nuclear weapons over the years, is indeed the, if you want to consider it an improvement, is the major advance that we have achieved in simply making them smaller?
Yeah, smaller and therefore lighter.
Right. Yeah, and easier to, and that if you're going to, whatever manner you choose to deliver this, whether it's an artillery shell or it's a ballistic missile or whatever, then that's, your interest is in making your warhead smaller and lighter.
And that's a very mature science, it's a science and art. So this, you know, you could make further small improvements, but just not worth it. There's no reason to do that. And that's one of the reasons the United States has no need to design new nuclear weapons. One of the basis for the U.S. decision to enter into a comprehensive test ban treaty.
Mm-hmm. That was what we, as we mentioned a couple of times, that was the topic of the last conversation that we had. As people will recall, that this was defeated in a vote of the Senate. Probably not only because senators seemed to have concerns they could articulate about why they thought the test ban was not a good thing, but also we have to say that it was complicated by the relationship between the Republicans in the Senate and the President, and that we're not expecting that anything is going to happen now until we have a new President, and then perhaps not even then. I wonder, for people who work in the arms control arena, what the thinking is about when we might revisit this issue.
Well, the most optimistic view is that we'll revisit it early in the next administration, but some of the concerns that were raised will have to be answered. Many of those concerns have answers, but there was no chance in the process that took place to get the answers out. As you mentioned, much of the vote and the acrimony that was present in the hearings that led up to it, which were very brief, had to do with strong feelings of disagreement between the Congress and the White House. But it's also true the White House administration hadn't prepared the Congress the way an administration needs to do before a treaty. Another controversial treaty that was in the news recently was the Panama Canal Treaty. But in fact, that was ratified by the Senate. But the Carter administration worked carefully with members of the Congress who were concerned about this and that matter over a considerable period of time, and slowly built up support for the treaty, and it was successfully ratified. That's something the Clinton administration didn't do, and the next administration will have to do that. There will probably be some other minor changes, increments added to the verification that will address some of the concerns that were raised. But there's a lot of homework to be done, so it won't be year one in a new administration, but maybe year two is a possibility. But time will tell, and of course if some other state starts testing, that will complicate the matter enormously.
Yeah.
But we're not going to. There's no call from the Department of Defense to do that and the like.
Well, when we come back to this, are we still going to be arguing over the basic points of whether, A, it will or will not interfere with the U.S. defense and our ability to develop new weapons? And the other point that was raised by opponents of the treaty was essentially that it's not really going to prevent another country from developing nuclear weapons or from testing, as an earlier caller said. Well, another country might just say, well, I don't care whether you think I should test or have weapons or not, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yes, there's no treaty or political agreement or measure or program or defense which will prevent another state that's determined in developing nuclear weapons and going ahead and testing them. But they'll be doing it in the face of world condemnation if we have a comprehensive test ban treaty in force. And our own security isn't fundamentally altered if a state like India or Pakistan tests a few crude weapons. I mean, continued nuclear proliferation is a serious matter, but one more doesn't make a fundamental difference to the United States, given what it has. Yes, many of the same arguments will be revisited, that's for sure, but there'll be a chance, if the process is done well, to hear the other side of those arguments and to what really matters. And that's what's important, and why the treaty on balance is enormously beneficial to the United States. Everything's a balance in this business.
At that, we will have to stop for right now because we're here at the end of the time. But again, I'm sure that some of these things we'll be coming back to in future. But for the moment, we say thanks very much.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Our guest, Jeremiah Sullivan, he's professor of physics here at the University of Illinois.